Hey folks, this month it's the 10th annual Men's Warehouse National Suit Drive. Donate your gently used professional attire, including suits, dress shirts, dress shoes, ties, and more to any Men's Warehouse store from July 1st to 31st and give a man the chance to transform his life. The goal is to reach 275,000 donations, so be sure to spread the word by using the hashtag GiveASuit. Visit menswarehouse.com-national-suit-drive. That's men's, WEAR house.com/national-suit-drive for more information. As a thank you for donating, you'll receive a coupon for 50% off regular price retail items and get $10 off your $50 purchase when you text NSD to 66960. All right, get rid of those suits in a good way. All right, let's do the show.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckocrats? What the fuck publicans? The fuse of you? And of course, you what the fuck nicks? Welcome. This is my show. This is Mark Maron talking in your head. As you drive or exercise or run or bake or whatever the hell you paint, it's hot here, man. It's over 100. And I got to turn the air conditioner off in here in order to record to have this wonderfully professional sounding product. Today on the show, this is the last of a series of shows that we've been doing revolving around the Netflix show GLOW, The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which I am part of. It was a great opportunity, really, for this show, anyways, to sort of like track the creation of the show in a lot of ways, or at least understand it and be part. You know, I'm part of a production that isn't my show, and I'm working with a producer that's a genius. And I've today on the show we've got the showrunners, the creators of the show, Carly Mensch and Liz Flahive, and we've also got the writing team, Rachel Schuchert, Nick Jones and Sasha Rothschild. I actually put this in the can when they were still on the set of GLOW. The writers, anyways, Liz and Carly came over here. The showrunners did, but this is sort of the ground level of the creation in the way that, you know, the showrunners or the creators of the show created the show. So we can talk to them about that. And the writers, you know, it was interesting to talk to them about how they were able to, you know, generate these characters. There's so many characters. And also that it was nice that they were writing while we were shooting so that they could voice my character a little bit more like me when they knew what it was that I could do. So this is the last of the batch of the GLOW episodes. And this is a good one. It's good, you know, especially if you're I don't want to use the word creator. It's too vague. But if you're a writer who wants to get into TV writing, this should have some valuable information. And these are good people. Decent people. The lot of them. Man, the show. People are loving the show. I couldn't be more excited about that. Speaking about shows, I would like to bring your attention. Now, a friend of mine, he's been on the show before. He's a very funny dude. I love watching him do comedy. His name's Brian Scalero. You might remember him. Got a great voice. Scalero's got a great voice. He's got a new comedy album out. It's called Stupid Time, a sketch album. You can get it on iTunes or allthingsrecords.com. Check out Brian's record. He's a funny guy. So I will tell you what I've been up to the last couple of days. Over the weekend, Senator Al Franken asked me to moderate a conversation with him over in Beverly Hills at the Wallace Theater, the Wallace Center for the Performing Arts. He asked me a couple of weeks ago. I said, of course, we did that at BookCon. We got a good thing going. I had him on the podcast. I interviewed him at BookCon live. We had some good shtick going. He's in top form, both as a senator and a guy that cares with a big heart, but also as a funny man. Al is a fucking hilarious comedic performer and writer on top of being an amazingly, big hearted progressive senator. And I love working with him, but it was sort of amazing that it did become sort of a team shtick. Like, cause, you know, I knew which stories like landed great, and all his stories, some of them are really, cause he's a great comedy writer, structured beautifully, almost like jokes you would read, long stories. And so by the third time I worked with him live, we really had kind of a team dynamic going. And I didn't say this to him, but, you know, if he, you know, if he ever retires from the Senate, I wouldn't mind maybe hitting the road for some gigs. He used to be in a team. He knows how to do it. I know how to do it. I'm a pretty good straight man for the senator. What was funny is that, and I believe he's a great senator, and, you know, he's doing great work. He's got balls. He's got courage, and he's righteous in a real way. And he's done some great things lately, in terms of, calling, you know, certain people out, yeah, as just a line of questioning on a committee and yielding some pretty amazing viral videos at the very least, but also some monumental shifts in the process of government at this moment in time. But what surprised me was we were talking the other day, and we did this didn't happen the first time we did it. And I'm really doing this as a build up to tell a dirty joke. So if you're thinking about fast forwarding, there's a pretty good dirty joke coming. So Al, we're talking, I'm talking to Al, and we're talking about his dad, and, you know, if he grew up with comedy in the house, and Al tells me that his dad was a great Buddy Hackett fan, and who wasn't? Buddy Hackett was really the funniest guy I knew of when I was a little kid. My grandmother loved Buddy Hackett. She used to go, yeah, but Grandma Goldie used to say, like, very funny. We see him in Vegas, but he's filthy. The word filthy needs more play. But Al's telling me that, you know, his father loved Buddy Hackett and always did. And years after his father passed away, he ran into Buddy Hackett on an airplane and said, Mr. Hackett, my father was a great fan of yours, and you made him very happy. You were his favorite comic to something. I'm paraphrasing. And Buddy Hackett turned to Al and went into this joke, which I will tell. And to see, but I want you to picture Al Franken telling this. Senator Al Franken. It's beautiful. It was beautiful. I wish we had it on tape. Guy goes into the doctor. He's got a dot on his head. And he says, Doc, what is this? The doc says, yeah, I've not seen that before. Guy says, well, what is it? The doctor says, well, what's happening is you're going to have where that dot is, a penis is going to grow out of your forehead. In about 6 months, you'll have a full grown penis growing out of your forehead. So the guy says, well, can you cut it off? And the doctor says, no, because it's connected directly to your brain. And then the guy says, well, you mean, you know, in 6 months' time, I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to look in the mirror and I'm going to see a penis hanging off of my forehead, just sticking out there? And the doctor goes, no, you won't be able to see it because the balls will be hanging in your eyes. The balls will be hanging in your eyes. That's a hell of a turn. That's a Buddy Hackett joke conveyed to me by Senator Al Franken in the context of a tribute to his father who loved Buddy Hackett. And it gave me the opportunity to tell you that dirty joke. Classic dirty joke with a beautiful twist at the end. What more can you ask for on a Monday morning? Am I right? Right now, it's my chance to remind you to avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international, with Stamps.com. Stamps.com lets you buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Click print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, people. Never closes because you have control. Print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Middle of the night postage. If you've ever listened to this show before, you've probably heard me talk about Stamps.com at least once. And that's because I've been using it for almost 7 years. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in WTF. That's Stamps.com. Enter WTF. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. That's how you hit a button. You got it? You won't be able to see it because the balls will be hanging in your eyes. Get it? Got it? Let's get into this. Let's get into the writers. Rachel? No. Rachel Schuchert, Nick Jones, and Sasha Rothschild were the primary writers, the writer's room of GLOW. And I spoke to them at the production facility out there at the sound stages. And we talked about being writers. If that's of interest to you, here it comes. All right. So Rachel, Nick, Sasha, the writers for GLOW. I've said the words of all of you. I've had problems with some of the words, Nick. There was actually no real struggles on set. I'm going to talk about me for a while. I thought I was I was a real mensch about.
Yeah.
I thought your writings were all good, and I didn't fight for anything.
We were worried about you.
Were you going in?
Yeah. We didn't know how ornery you would be.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have a shockingly cheery disposition on set.
I didn't have to worry about much. I thought, like, this isn't on me. If this thing craps out, it's their thing. I just have to show up and do my job.
Yeah.
I was a working man.
That's how we feel.
Yeah.
I also made the discovery late in the shoot that the crankier you got, the funnier you got.
That is true.
Your crankiest day, I thought you were on fire.
Is that true?
Yeah.
What day was that?
No, we talked about it.
It was episode 8 up in the office, and then I think we also did the car scene.
Yeah.
With Allie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Car
right,
scenes
right.
with Allie always made you cranky.
Well, you're sitting there in the car, and there's like my resentment is that I'm in a car on a trailer, and you guys are sitting in your little cubby up there, kind of laughing and talking about other things, and I'm just sitting in a fucking trailer watching you guys just have a day. It's a problem.
Welcome to being a star.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Think about how much more you get paid than we do.
Do I?
Probably.
I don't know. This is like
I hope so. I would think so.
I
hope so.
I don't think we should go down that road.
You don't? You want to talk numbers?
We could.
You don't want to talk numbers?
I liked when you would yell at yourself because you would never yell at others, which I thought was a mensch, very mensch-like.
That's true.
You're a mensch, Mark. Who knew?
I didn't want to be one of those assholes. So let's go, like, what have you written on, Rachel, before this?
I wrote on Supergirl last season, and I wrote on this show called Red Band Society that ran on Fox for one season.
And what'd you do before that?
Oh, all kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
I wrote books mostly and for
really?
Magazines and, yeah, as a playwright.
Oh, really? You were a playwright?
Yeah.
And
so
you wrote
Nick.
Books?
Yeah.
I know, like, there's a lot of playwrights because Carly and Liz are playwrights.
Mm-hmm. Well, we all know each other from that. For like 10, 11 years. Nick and Carly and Liz and I were all in the same writers group at Ars Nova in New York in like 2006.
I knew no one.
Yeah, I know.
So
you're
Sasha
a Hollywood
was the
person.
Sasha's a Hollywood
so
person.
So Hollywood.
Yeah. You're like the outlier. All these people are New York intelligentsia.
Yeah, they're very smart.
The highbrows.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were before we came to LA, but
but when you were doing plays, tell me about Nick. I'll get to you. Don't worry, Sasha.
I'm not worried.
Nick, so like, tell me about your first play that you put up.
Well, I mean, I started doing plays in college that I wrote and starred in and did in the multi-purpose room.
Yeah, like Orson Welles.
Like Orson Welles, but
exactly.
Like much worse. And then I came to New York and I started doing puppet shows because I couldn't figure out how to do plays that required all the resources that I had in college. So I actually was like a puppeteer when I met these guys.
Really?
Yeah.
You had a trunk full of puppets?
I had this group called Jolly Ship the Whiz Bang.
A puppet.
And it was like a rock band with puppets.
Like what
and
kind?
I did that for like 10 years.
Hand puppets?
Yeah. They were like rod puppets you manipulated from below. And for a while, I wanted to be a puppeteer. Like,
really?
I was like, I want to be a puppeteer musician because I figured like that's something no one else is, and so the bar is very low.
Yeah,
I was like, no one will know if I'm not the best in the business because I'm the only one in this business.
Well, it just sounds like there's that angle, and there's also the angle that you wanted to guarantee your failure.
Yeah, well, and I sort of was doing both. I was hedging my bets.
So you did some puppeteering, some rock puppeteering.
Yeah, I did that for my 20s, all my 20s, basically.
Did you have a following?
I mean,
you did.
It was successful for what it was.
10 or 15 people that were always there.
Were there shows that you? Like,
yeah, I mean, I kept doing it with my friends because it kept leading to interesting experiences. I wasn't making money, but it was like
someone, what?
Like someone was like, "I'm putting together a puppet festival in Bangkok. Would you like to come out here for a month?" So yes, I will. So we did that. I ended up going.
You played Bangkok with the puppets.
Yeah,
yeah.
I went to Ireland. I went all over.
Really?
And then Ars Nova eventually produced the show.
Uh huh.
And it was a success for what it was. And then that led to getting an agent.
Writing for humans.
Yeah. Eventually, like painfully, I've learned how to write for humans barely. Without much nuance, because I didn't learn that, because you don't need that with puppets.
No,
but
the puppets don't talk.
It's all right. It's just television.
So. Yeah, the puppets don't have notes.
Do you miss the puppets, Nick? Or?
I mean, you should stop by my house. Yeah. The puppets are still there.
Yeah, he still lives among them.
I just took them out of the boxes, and I'm trying to find a place for them in my life again.
Okay, so when you were doing this, who were your heroes? Were you thinking like, all right, this is a career that I respect creatively. I'm going to emulate that. Was it like a Jim Henson or?
I mean, everyone loves Jim Henson. I wasn't emulating him because I wanted to make a puppet show that didn't look like the Muppets or those like plush puppets that are in everything.
Right. Well, is Saving Sarah Marshall somehow based on you?
Oh God, no. And that was the bane of my existence at the time, because that's when I was like deep in it. And if for a while I was very proud to be a puppeteer, you know,
because
whatever, you enter a conversation at least with that.
Yeah.
That was my calling card.
And women love it.
Women loved it. It was the best of times.
Uh-huh.
I was in my prime. But then Sarah Marshall came along, and that hijacked the conversation. If I mentioned the puppet shows, they're like, oh, have you seen Sarah?
Oh, really?
Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Rained on your parade.
Right. Yeah, and then we'd have to talk about that fucking movie instead of me.
The important work you were doing with puppets.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So where'd you come from, Sasha? You're like, you have a sordid history, don't you?
I sure do. I come from Miami Beach.
Oh, that's already.
If we're really going way back.
That's the worst start I've ever heard.
South Beach.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
I was born in the swamps of Everglades City.
Really?
And then when I was three, we had to flee to Miami because my father wrote an article for Rolling Stone exposing all the drug dealers smuggling drugs up through the swamps of Everglades City to Miami.
Pretty happy about that, and, that accomplishment?
He wasn't. He was just, he thought it was a good story. He didn't actually fully think through.
He was a journalist.
He was a journalist.
Right.
He was not anti-drug. He just was a journalist.
Right.
So ended up growing up in Miami Beach and knew that
undercover?
On
the run?
He, once we got to Miami, it was sort of, it wasn't, he was, I, you know what, I don't know why no one killed him, actually. He was safe for whatever reason.
Wow.
And continued to be a
journalist. That sounds like a good story in and of itself.
It
Maybe
is.
He'll tell that story.
He could tell you
who
that
story. Who was protecting him.
I know, yeah. Well, he, yeah. I still don't know all the details of what really went on. But crazy place to grow up. He was a writer. I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to write for television. So I moved to L.A. when I was 21.
Really?
And immediately started waitressing.
Right, of course.
And waitressed at the Improv years ago, where I crossed paths with you, but you didn't. You weren't
you
aware of
never
my existence, but I was very aware of your existence.
Really?
I was
not a big waitress. I didn't get involved. I don't know.
You were smart.
Well, I knew it happened, and it's not like it didn't happen in my life, but like I just didn't do it because like how many of those conversations were you like, who am I following? You know, like not on stage, but I mean literally, which guys do I know?
Sure,
And
are they funnier than me?
There's that, yeah. Like you fucked him,
He's a hack.
He's
you
a
can't
hack,
believe you fucked him. Totally.
So all right, so you fuck some comics.
So I fuck some comics and learned how to write a joke. And
was one of the reasons you took the gig there?
I was an assistant on a late night show, and I knew that I would never be a writer on that show because they would never hire me as a writer. The Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I learned a lot about joke writing by watching the writers, but knew I wouldn't get a shot. And I thought, my time is going to be better served actually cocktailing, making a little money, listening to comics all night long.
Did you learn?
I did. I learned. I learned why jokes land. I learned the rhythm of jokes.
Just on your own. No one was telling you.
No, I just by listening. Just by listening.
Absorbed.
And then was having a hard time breaking in to TV, and then was having a hard time breaking into movies, and then started writing articles, and immediately LA Weekly.
Yeah.
And I wrote a couple articles for Playboy, and I wrote a couple articles for Maxim, and
back when there were
places,
magazines,
when there were actual mm-hmm. magazines, yeah. And then one of my articles took off. It was called "How to Get Divorced by 30," and then within 1 week, I got a movie deal at Universal and a book deal at Penguin. So it took 10 years to be an overnight success.
Mm. That's pretty low. That's like a good number.
It was a good, yeah. So
that can take a lot longer now.
It can take a lot
for
longer.
For me,
than
I know it was
years.
25. Yeah. So like I was on that plan.
You're on the 25-year plan.
Yeah,
well, you're doing pretty well now.
I'd given up on it, you know, but it was, it's 25 years. So, okay, yeah. So there you were. You got these deals, but deals don't necessarily mean anything. Was the book a bestseller?
The book was not a bestseller, but it did okay.
Yeah.
And then from that, and then I wrote the movie script, which, of course, the movie's never going to get made, but it put me on the map for features, and then I've continued to write movies, and then from there have sort of consistently developed in TV, and then...
All right, well, let's not just brush over that.
Okay, all right.
So have you had any movies made?
No.
How many movie scripts have you sold?
Seven movie scripts at seven studios all across town.
It's pretty impressive.
And, you know, every now and again I get a call that so-and-so just, you know, attach themselves to something. And then I get another call in 3 months saying, that's not going to happen. Yeah.
Seven scripts you got paid for, and they're still sort of active if they want them.
I would say two out of the seven are active.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then what was your first TV job?
My first TV job was actually selling a half hour to NBC with a friend of mine. And that was called My Best Friend's a Lesbo, because she's a lesbo. And that did not go to series, but it was
a great experience.
That was 4 years ago.
This is sort of... As the heyday is ending of making huge money on half-hour development deals,
yes,
and selling scripts.
Yeah. And then I had such a great experience working in TV, even though it didn't end up airing, that I really focused on TV, and then got a job working on Carrie Diaries, which was a delightful show, which was the prequel to Sex and the City about Carrie Bradshaw.
Yeah.
Which was really a...
And that was just a couple years ago?
Couple years ago, last gig I had, Carrie Dyers, and then development. And then this show, I actually watched Glow as a child and loved it. And so when I read this pilot, I thought it was amazing.
Why did you love it?
As a little girl, I thought that some of those women were so pretty.
They were so glamorous and fancy.
Outfits were so shiny and sparkly, and I would just watch them come out in this sort of glitzy glamour and then get like down and dirty and sweat and be badass. And it really spoke to me in a way of like sort of the high low of it all. Like, ooh, I can be pretty, but I can also kick ass.
And grunt.
Mm-hmm. And, I remember Chainsaw loving, and I remember the Southern Bells towards the end of the later series had the Southern Bells with their big hoop skirts, and Hollywood and Vine. I love the Bad Girls. I loved it. It was.
And you watched it as a kid too, or no?
I remember it.
Yeah?
I didn't watch it a lot. I remember my mother seeing them on Donahue, I think.
Donahue.
And thinking it was hilarious and telling me all about it. And then I watched it, I think, a couple times. But I was a little bit too little.
I remember the appearance on Married with Children.
Yeah.
Were you a wrestling guy?
No, I wasn't. I should have been, but you would think I was, but I wasn't.
What was your last TV gig? We didn't go over your TV history. We went over puppets and we stopped.
Well, I was on Orange is the New Black for
Genji.
For 4 years. Yeah.
For 4 years.
Like, yeah. Until now.
And that was your first TV job?
Yeah.
I developed
some things too, but it was my first staffing job. And
so you went to the school of Genji.
I went to the school of Genji. I moved to L.A. for Genji for that job once I got it.
Uh-huh.
And then I've been here like 4.5 years later.
But you did a few. We already talked about it, right?
Yeah, I did a couple.
Yeah, but this is the first. Like, you love this one more than the others?
Yeah, it's much more like me. You know,
because
it's one thing to work on sort of network television that's like a little bit, I mean, not bad, but it is what it is. It's like a
this is how you do it, you know.
Right. Real network television is a nightmare.
Yeah, it's, you know,
and then you got to deal with showrunners who think they know everything, and then you got to deal with, you know, executives that don't know anything but have to pretend like they know things, and ugh, it's the worst.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to deal with that. I was at IFC. So how did you get this gig?
Well, I mean,
well, you were in house almost.
I mean, I was in house, but also like Carly was on Orange Is the New Black last season, and we, you know, we were already friends. And
Carly, our showrunner,
Carly,
our leader, one of our leaders,
And I was actually on a hike with her in Griffith Park when she got the call that Netflix was going to pick up the show to series. You know, that's a holy shit moment.
Yeah,
and obviously I'm thrilled for her, but I'm also like, fuck, well, I guess you're not going to be coming back to Orange next year.
Right, right.
You know, and she was one of my, you know, allies.
Buddies, yeah.
And you need allies in a writer's room.
You do?
Why are you staring at me?
As Sasha will tell you. No, I don't know.
We're
what
all
I mean
allies
by that.
In this room,
like, I think we're all allies.
Yeah.
But I've had the experience where, you know, two people agree with, more often than two others, and if one person calls in sick, then suddenly there's not enough of the people on your side to like push a bill through.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But isn't that really kind of relative to the showrunner? I mean, is it really kind of?
I think
the showrunner is not always in the room. Also, you know, like the showrunner has so many duties that like while the showrunner's away. You know,
the room runs itself sometimes.
Oh, see, I never had that experience. Because, like, my room was like, I had my showrunners, and there was me and three other guys. That was the whole crew.
Right.
So they were there for all the writing, and they were writers on it. And it would go through me, and then it would sort of go through them. But we just sit there looking at each other. There was no real clicks. You know, everyone was sort of...
Well, that's good. That's better.
Well, I think there's a couple versions of that, though. Because sometimes it's just like a... It's not like... calculated or anything. It's just like an affinity, you know,
right,
like you just get along better with somebody, you connect with somebody better. And then there's the other version of it where there really is this like insane political clusterfuck where people are being like strategic about who they sort of suck up to and who they shut out in the room. And, and that's the worst. I mean, that's like the horrible, that's when it feels like you're going to work in like Game of Thrones and, people are like forging alliances against you.
Well, this doesn't feel like that because, you know, there's not that weird network pressure. And, you know, clearly Netflix is like, here, have some money. You need more money? Here's some more money. And do you have enough to eat on set? Is that
There's
more food coming.
Really nice. From top to bottom. I also think that Carly and Liz did a good job of hiring, like, the right people for the right reasons.
Where do you meet with them? How did you get the gig?
I got a call from my agents that this Gen G show was, you know, Netflix based on this thing called Glow. And I was like, holy shit, I know about Glow. I was obsessed with Glow as a little girl. And I read the pilot, and they had read my HBO pilot. So they brought me in for a meeting. And I just sat down with Liz and Carly and Tara, who's Gen G's producing partner, and just said, I love this script and I want this job. And I kind of was very forthcoming and not like trying to be cool or play games. And
no one else had said that.
Good angle.
Many, I think when you go, look, when there's staffing season and you go from meeting to meeting, with showrunners to get staffed, you can have a certain armor of like, whatever, you know, I don't care whatever, wherever I land is fine, or I have so many options. And I think that having that armor is safe because most of the time you never get a job and you have to have armor. But for this particular situation, I had no armor.
You're excited.
I was
right.
really excited and really genuinely thrilled to try and be a part of this. And I think that's, you know, maybe what...
It doesn't always happen because I think the dream of writers usually is to deliver a show of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, the more you try to do that along with going in for writing jobs... You get beat down.
Yeah.
So if you developed a bunch of shows, you tried to sell shows and it never happened and you're going on 20, 30 years of this shit, you know, you just getting a writing job is not that big a deal. And it's just something you crankily kind of get through.
I think Gen G fosters an environment, and I think Liz and Carly do as well, where everyone they hire gets to feel invested.
Yeah, they're very generous that way.
Which makes us come in with our best work, you know, and staves off the sense of being jaded, and it's just a job. Like, I think we're made to feel like we're all making this thing together, which is
great.
Amazing. Yeah.
I didn't know if I was going to be able to take this job. It was like a very dramatic week because I was on Supergirl and we didn't know if we were coming back and they kept not telling us. And there was all this like weird negotiation behind the scenes and nobody would like sort of give anyone a straight answer about anything. And so the producers at Supergirl were like, look, we want you all back, but like, we don't know what's going to happen. So you should go on other meetings. And if anybody gets something that they really want to take it and we'll let you go and it won't be a problem. And then everything kind of happened all at the same time where I went on like two meetings. I went on, you know, this one, which sort of, you know, I remember you came into my house and you were like, listen, Carly just got the show picked up. And then like UTA called me the next day and they're like, how well do you know Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch? And I was like, pretty well. And it was like this whole thing. And so then I had the meeting and then they were, you know, taking a while to kind of figure everything out, I think, in terms of like budget or whatever it was. And I was still waiting to hear about this. And then I got another offer on another show. And they were like, well, she has to get out of Supergirl though. And so we were going to maybe try to do that. And then I got the offer for Glow and I was like, I want to do Glow. Let's do Glow. But then there was all this weird back and forth because then Supergirl got like picked up the same day to the CW and they weren't going to let me out of the contract. And so there had to be all this like weird back channel stuff. And it was really tense.
Yeah.
That's why we have agents.
Yeah. Yes. That's why we have agents.
And, mm-hmm. and I was in first position on another thing. And it had an intense weekend leading up to taking this and was actually on my way to Greenland with my mother and sister.
Oh, yeah.
And that's was right. on a flight.
The I Greenland?
Was, the Greenland.
Not,
the
it's
Greenland.
Not like the name of a supermarket.
No, it's the actual Greenland and was Greenland. On a flight from JFK to Copenhagen on the plane when I got the call from my agent saying, get off the plane. You have to start Monday. And I raced off the plane, then took a cab from JFK to Newark, got on a plane, Newark to LA, and was in the room Monday morning.
Really?
And sent my mother and sister to Greenland without me.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I was just pacing my living room, like weeping to my agents on the phone.
It's very dramatic.
It was very dramatic.
It's weird though, the stakes seem awfully high for something that doesn't seem to, like, there's no life or death to it, but like those moments where you get a call back and you're like, well, fuck, I gotta fly in, you know. I hate that about show business.
It's
like,
true.
It's like you end up doing nothing forever and then all of a sudden there's a panic to do like a 5-minute thing with a executive.
Well, the one day you finally book the vacation is the day you get the call
to
get off the plane.
It's a good way to guarantee
you
that.
You should always book it's like going to the bathroom and then your food comes.
Restaurant. But I like that when that happens. Yeah, I go to the bathroom on purpose to make the food come.
It's a surprise. I do realize that some fancier restaurants will not put the food down if you're not there, though.
They'll really?
Wait. Yeah.
That's so passive aggressive.
Yeah, it's
do they know
up.
That you're in the bathroom just to make them bring the
doing
food?
Doing a childish trick.
So it's like a game of chicken. Who can wait longer?
Game of chicken.
But yeah, I mean, I had to be at a general meeting for Fox Studios way back, and I was moving from New York for this Fox deal. This is why I came out to LA in 2002 because I had a deal with Fox, and we're driving a U-Haul across country to move, and the fucking U-Haul that we rented in New York broke down. Like it's somewhere in Pennsylvania. Like it was just horrible. We had to, because it was the middle of the night. I had to be there, the day. Like I only had a certain amount of days to get there, and it was cutting into it. We had to shift to another U-Haul, and it was a disaster. And it was very difficult for the woman that I was with.
Sure.
But we made it.
Did you make you made the meeting?
Yeah.
It changed your life.
Did nothing.
Yeah.
The script I wrote the script with a guy. It went nowhere.
The beginning, everything's a big break.
Yeah.
And then you have like,
there's so
like
many
20
don't
breaks
happen.
Where nothing happened and when you did everything perfectly and then you actually have something happen that just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So you're just like, whatever. You just stay busy and things happen.
But all those meetings eventually sort of add up to some sort
to
of presence or
the
something.
Experience having meetings and being known by people.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well,
so then they're like, oh my God, we love Mark, even though you had like one 15-minute conversation 12 years ago.
Yeah, that was never what they said about me for a long time. It's like, how is he?
I find it
How's
weird
he doing?
When you have general meetings where you're meeting the same people who are now working at different studios. Or different
And they already know you.
Or do they?
But then you realize it's their job just to have you come in. What do they fucking do? They do nothing.
They
just like with comics, general meetings, they're like, well, who do you want? Who can entertain us today?
Yeah.
They have to justify their dumb jobs.
Yeah.
And you're just, oh, yeah, bring some writers in. We should fucking, yeah, what are you doing after lunch? It's the worst. They are, our futures are hanging. I know that I shouldn't be talking like this about these lovely executives, but I don't give a fuck. But our future is hanging in their hands. So what did you have to do to get up to speed on wrestling? I knew nothing about it, and I was so relieved to be told that I didn't need to. Like, they were like, no, your guy doesn't know anything about it. I'm like, perfect.
Well, we didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know
anything. I'm a little bit of a fan. I mean, I was a little bit of a fan of watching wrestling and knew a teeny little amount.
I was on this medical show, and that's how we used to, and it would be like, and then, like, you'd have the idea of the story, and then there'd be, and then there'll be a scene with some medical, and we'll figure that out, and we had, like, a liaison to the, who's like, so figure out, like, what would really happen if your liver shut down or whatever.
Right.
And then you would just, they'd, like, put in, like, a bunch of, like, gibberish that, like, the audience doesn't really pay attention to, and then you just go on with the scene.
Anyone could do what we do. A monkey could do it.
But the weird thing about wrestling, the thing that makes it interesting is that how, like, the big shift right in the first two episodes is how do you take a volatile, you know, broken trust, you know, betrayal of a friendship and then put that at the core,
right,
of, you know, the heel and the face dynamic of wrestling. I mean, so, like, it, right from the beginning, it becomes a personal story, but then it just translates immediately to the ring.
Yeah. Well, that was the cool thing that we kind of found out about wrestling, is that it does, it's like this larger than life encapsulation of, like, problems. You know, it has all this, because when they go in the ring, it's like there's these beefs, you know, and there's like this kind of soap opera, and that this has been going on, and so and so stole whoever's woman, and then they were humiliated by this other person. So it's this constant, like, sort of settling of scores,
right,
that you're supposed to believe is real.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to sort of take that construct and apply it to this show where there were real things happening, you know?
Right.
That, like, stuff actually happened offstage, and, like, all of that backstory that's fake in the wrestling world was real in this one.
Now, when you look, if it, you know, you think ahead, like, I didn't when I was doing my show. I just assumed every season would be the last season. But it seems like this world as a world is completely unique for a lot of reasons. But also, you have so many fucking characters that, like, to fill another two seasons doesn't seem like that big of a stretch if it happens, does it?
Yeah, it could go on a
long
time.
I think it could go on a really long time.
Yeah, well, we have what? We have 15 main characters, so we could have 15 seasons.
Yeah, I think 15 seasons sounds about right. 15 seasons.
That's right, right?
Yeah. Well, I think in a way, and maybe, I mean, I think it's like the Orange is the New Black template in the terms of, like, the scope of the cast.
Yeah.
And you can,
like,
kind of focus in on different characters at different times.
Right.
With Orange, it's based on a memoir where a woman goes into prison for just over a year, you know, but you can have the same stories happen, but you just say, like, this episode takes place in a day or half a day, and you can move very slowly, and by, when I say pace, I mean just mean the sort of the
time frame of this,
the
show.
Time frame of it, you know, not that it moves
right
slowly.
So, like, you're saying that this could be, we could keep this 1986 1987 for 4 years.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, this whole season is supposed to be, what, like 10 weeks or something?
Yeah.
In real time?
Real time.
In the time,
yeah, a couple
of
months.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. But back to what you, it is cool, though, to have, like, that sort of deep a bench.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, it's because I think, too, like, coming off network television where you have these characters that are, like, set from the beginning, and there's this pressure to, like, service every single one of them in every episode, and some of them just don't pop, or they don't work, or the story you had for them doesn't, and you still have to think of something for them to do. Like, it's so nice to be able to just have someone, like, have one line in an episode and that you'll get to them later.
Yeah, and there's still, like when I look at the cast on the wall here, like, there's still so many backstories that have not been explored at all, really. Just hints.
Yeah. Just hints.
There's
of
really
people.
Only two or three main backstories in this season.
And I think it's nice for the actors, too, to sort of have a lot of time to feel out their characters so that, you know, in season two or three, when we get to some of those, like, deep bench characters, like, we've thought about them and we've watched those actors performing so much that we, a whole lot of story has already been suggested,
right?
You know?
And they feel so real. Like, there's
how
not
to
this
play
thing
it.
About having to, like, set them up and introduce them out of nowhere. I mean, that's kind of the great thing about
Orange in the
is,
world.
Like, when people come forward and suddenly have stories, you've just sort of seen them in the background already for, like, 3 years. Like, you're used to seeing them, and it doesn't feel like this new jarring person that you have to
and also, like,
explicate.
Exactly. But by next season, they're all going to know how to wrestle. So you can act, and by the end of this season, I believe we're going to be wrestling. Like, for real, right?
Yeah.
In a show.
Yeah.
So then, like, next season, you'll be able to frame episodes with actual matches, right?
Yeah.
It's just going to get more and more exciting.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the drama will ramp up at the same time that the wrestling violence will ramp up.
Yeah. Right. And the show will, like, start to get successful. Like, they'll start to have a presence in
the show within the
show.
The show within the show.
You know, they'll start to go out. They'll start to have fans and people.
Because right now
watching.
They're all unknown within the show.
Right. That's exciting. Yeah. So who do you think the audience is? Because I keep thinking, like, how can teenage girls not like this? Like,
I think the audience is a lot of different people.
No, I agree.
It's teenage girls. It's older. It's women that watched it as little girls. Mm-hmm. It's men who are obsessed with wrestling. It's gay guys who love the camp of what Flo used to be.
But I hope so much that young
I don't know a single
girls.
Gay guy who's like 37 who didn't watch Flo as a little
is that
boy.
True?
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah. It was like such a gateway
so it was a thing.
Show
it's
for
a
like young gay show. Boys. Yeah. A gateway show.
Because right, it was like a safe thing to watch without, because you weren't watching beauty pageants.
No,
you were
watching
wrestling.
You were watching wrestling.
Yeah.
Strong women.
Yeah.
And you guys did a great job. I enjoyed working with all of you. I enjoyed saying your lines. Was there any problems? Anybody? With me? Did you have any problems?
No problems. No. Nick
was sort of waiting for a problem. There's a couple
problems.
Nick didn't like having his like only man in the room kind of challenged.
Yes,
I think
true.
It's like a cock of the walk
and
thing.
He was no longer the
he was
one
no
cock.
Longer
I
mean, the
used,
one
I used
cock.
To be the male consultant when people had questions about what
about
it's like
men.
To be a man and what
like
a male character would do. But I feel like
in.
I've lost my edge.
Oh, come on.
I mean, not because you came in, but I've just been around only women for so long. Yeah. I don't even remember what being a man is like.
Well, it was funny because when the first time I did one of your scripts, I knew you were kind of ready to, you know, take the fight a little bit. Like, what's it? When's the problem going to happen?
Sure.
And then
sure.
Which episode was that first one? Because I remember there were some things where I was like, can I do it like this? But then it came around to where, like, yours was okay. Was I fun?
Three.
Who did
Episode
who did I fight the one ball on?
Episode
was it the one ball?
You fought me on that.
On the one ball.
The one ball.
Yeah. And it's probably going to be cut in editing anyways.
Well,
that's the way it goes. But I mean, episode 3 was a long haul for me.
Which one was that?
It was the one where
you go
to the party.
In Malibu.
You go to the party in Malibu.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah.
Episodes 3 are always hard. Like, episode 3 is always the hardest.
Really?
In my experience. Yeah. Because I feel like you've got the pilot. The pilot's done when you start. Then everyone
episode
sort of knows what's going to happen.
Off the
episode
things that
paying
were set
off the pilot.
Up in the pilot.
And then 3, it's like, oh, now it's a show. And so
you have
now
to set up what will
write.
Take you through the season.
Well, you were actually the only one. Like, I don't know if it's a confidence thing or not, but like, there was you're always writing jokes. You know, or things like
on
set. Like, you maybe try it like that, and then maybe try it like that. And then, we do it. And then you ultimately you'd be like, let's just do the original.
I mean, the truth is, I actually don't have so much confidence in the written word. I only know things until I see them in the monitor.
You're always like when we would do plays, you were always giving alts and things like that. And I don't like to do that. And we would fight and yell at each other.
Well, we've worked together, by the way.
Yeah,
we've written plays together.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's too late to talk about that now. But
no, it's always
marriage
fine.
For a long time.
Yeah,
really, you guys were like tight and you do plays.
These two are like best friends.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
we do stuff.
We do stuff.
Yeah,
how many are those plays? Have they been produced?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Published.
Mm-hmm. They're
what
out
are
there.
They called?
They're out there.
We wrote a play called The Nosemaker's Apprentice, Chronicles of a Medieval Plastic Surgeon, which is as silly as it sounds.
The ancient art of nosemaking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we wrote one about a brothel in turn-of-the-century Chicago called The Sporting Life, which we've turned into a pilot and are shopping around with Gingy.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's exciting.
A
musical.
It's a musical.
It's a musical?
Yeah.
A musical television
show about prostitutes.
And old-timey Chicago.
Perversions.
Yeah. Everyone's just fighting over
it. Well, you never know. It's a big landscape now.
Yeah.
It's true. CISO will pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
CISO's hot right now.
I think
it's a place to get some money.
I heard Nabisco's getting into the game.
Oh, well.
Really?
No. But do you see?
Nabisco's going to have a network.
Anything's possible.
Nabisco. All right, you guys. Well, hopefully it's all going to – we're going to do more. Right?
Yeah.
That's the hope.
Hopefully we'll be together for many years.
We'll
see each other through many life spaces.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
many
for
marriages.
Talking. Yes.
All right. This is fun.
That was Rachel Shukert, Nick Jones, Sasha Rothschild, the writer's room at GLOW. And they did a great job. I mean, you saw their work. They did it. They did a great job. So before I talk to Carly Mensch and Liz Flahive, I do want, this is exciting. All right. This is, yeah, it's an ad, but it's also exciting. I'm sitting here in my garage looking at the wall, and hanging on it is a cartoon image of me from about, I don't know, like 22, 23 years ago. And if you saw this image, you would have no doubt where it came from, because the only show that looked like that was Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. I've actually got an animated cell of my face from Dr. Katz. That show, Dr. Katz, had so many fans. In fact, I have guests all the time who notice it and remember how much they love Dr. Katz. And now, for the first time in years, there's a brand new Dr. Katz for you to enjoy. The cult classic TV comedy is now Dr. Katz, the audio files. And it's now a free premium podcast at audible.com/Dr. Katz. Join 15 of comedy's biggest stars as they bare their souls on the couch with Hollywood's favorite shrink, Jonathan Katz, for 15 minutes. Eavesdrop on Sarah Silverman, Ted Danson, Ray Romano, Weird Al Yankovic, if you thought there might be another one, Kristen Schaal, Maria Bamford, Paul F. Tompkins, some guy named John Hamm, and someone else named Moore. Comedians and actors finally get the therapy they need, and you get free antidepressants in your ears. Listen to Dr. Katz, the audio files, available exclusively now at audible.com/Dr. Katz. That's audible.com/DRKATZ. Dig it. Dr. Katz is back. So, Carly Mensch, Liz Flahive, these were pretty seasoned writers, the two of them were, before they got to GLOW, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. Liz Flahive wrote on Nurse Jackie, Homeland. She was a playwright before that. You may know her plays From Up Here and the Madrid are two of her shows, her plays. Carly Mensch wrote for Weeds, Nurse Jackie, Orange is the New Black, and she's also a playwright who wrote All Hail Hurricane Gordo and Len, Asleep in Vinyl. Seasoned writers in at least two disciplines, and they created the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the show that I am on, and this is me talking to them here in the garage. Are you guys nervous in front of microphones? Have you never?
I've never done this before.
I've never done this, and I don't think I like the sound of my own voice, so I'm sure
God.
But I'm psyched.
You're psyched. I have talked to the other writers about you guys specifically at length and how difficult you were to work with, and I think we should just address that.
It's fine. Go for it. Hit hard.
So, all right, let's. Liz Flahive, Carly Mensch. I don't even know why I'm setting up like this. So you guys created and were the showrunners of GLOW, which I'm on, which
you
was
are.
good experience for me. How was it for you guys?
It was pretty idyllic.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like getting through making the first season of your first show, and like I only cried once.
When did you cry? When Trump won?
Yeah, exactly.
That was a lot of
night that everything fell apart.
That was a tough day on set.
Yeah, no, it was really brutal.
It was real tough. 14 women.
Yeah.
Wow. It was. Yeah. Everyone was just sort of like, "What? What happened?"
No, everyone just slowly crumbled.
Disbelief and horror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and we were pretending it's 1985 on set too, so it felt like we were retreating back to where we actually were setting the show.
Yeah, it's all relevant again.
It's funny because when we pitched the show, I remember we kind of started with we're on the verge of having our first female president.
I mean, I think we literally said this is a great time for women.
Yeah.
We're about to elect our first female president.
Right.
By this show.
So, all right. So tell me how, like, where did you guys know each other from, not working together on a show, but from how?
We met in New York. We were both at a writer's group at Ars Nova, which is this off-Broadway theater. And they started a writer's group for a bunch of playwrights. And we
heard about this. Did I talk to somebody else? Who was in that? Was Stephen Karam in that?
Stephen
did you tell
Karam,
me?
He was not in our year.
Our year had...
We were the first year, and it was
two of the writers on our show.
Yeah. Nick Jones and Rachel Shukert.
That's right.
Met, Bo Willimon, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Liz Merriweather.
Oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda was in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he would riff on the piano when, I think Nick brought in a play about
Nick brought in a musical.
Estate.
He brought in a musical called Little Building.
Yeah.
And he's like, I wrote this musical, but it has no music.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, well, how do we read it? And Lin was like, well, I'll just get on the piano and make stuff up. And we all improvised.
Yeah.
I played an airport, I remember. Uh-huh. And we all just improvised, like, songs and arias.
Then we had to read my shitty play afterwards, and I was like, Jesus.
Oh, that's the worst.
It's a bad night to have brought something in.
Was it, like, were you reading the whole play or just parts of it? It's, yeah.
I think we all brought in snippets of things that weren't finished, and it was also, like, my jokiest, dumbest play about Sally Struthers. Like, it was the...
And right after Lin-Manuel riffed a musical.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Like, Carly,
yeah,
can we...
Yeah.
Yeah. Go over years now?
Like, I was like, dive in. I hide in the bathroom.
But it was a great place. I mean, they gave us, you know, free beer and pizza twice a month, and we all hung out there. And it was just like a place that we could actually be, you know. It was
and workshop really, stuff?
Yeah. And like, we would, even when we weren't there, I was like, I need to read this pilot. Can I have the space to do it? And we'd bring people together. They were just very supportive of their people, and they still are.
And did you guys, you didn't write together, though?
No, never. And not until this.
And did you write whole plays?
Yeah.
And they were produced?
Yeah.
How were they received? What was your first play called?
My first play was called From Up Here.
Oh.
And Ars Nova was the first producer on it, and then it sort of outgrew their little space, and then we did it at Manhattan Theater Club.
Yeah.
In 07, 08.
And is it done now?
It's done now. There are a lot of young characters, so it's done now, like sometimes regionally, but a lot of colleges do.
So you have a French's... book?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we're both at Samuel
oh, French's. That was like...
Why we shot a scene there in the pilot.
Yeah. That was our biggest location. We're going to shoot at Samuel French. It's going to be thrilling.
That was the scene with the acting class?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were very precise about what plays were in the background.
No, we were not precise. We were picky as shit. Like,
really?
Like, take that poster down. Take those plays off. We want these plays over here. Like, we made set deck insane. We moved whole shelves of plays. We were nightmares.
Yeah.
And what was your play, big play?
My first play was called All Hail Hurricane Gordo. It was in the Humana Festival of New Plays.
Yeah.
I thought it was going fantastically, and then we got a review from Charles Isherwood at the New York Times that I think was like three sentences that said something along the lines of, I tried to find something nice to say about this play.
Oh, really? He actually said that, or you just...
That's verbatim. Like, I tried to find something nice to say about 23-year-old Carly Mensch's whimsical play.
Then he threw you under the bus on the age thing.
Yeah.
Right, you know, they'll do that.
So is yours being performed elsewhere?
That one actually does get performed.
Was that the plan, though? Were you guys like, we're going to be playwrights, or did you have... Were you young, ambitious, forward-thinking people that were like, well, this is just
theater's
a stepping...
Theater's going to be the future.
Yeah.
No. Was it a launching pad, or you really thought theater was going to be the future?
No, I mean, the people that I knew who could support themselves doing theater had either a trust fund or taught, you know, at universities
or
TV. So I was like, well, I don't have a trust fund, and I don't know about teaching, so maybe television.
Uh-huh.
So that was sort of what I tried to jump on and off of my first play and see if there was anything.
And how'd you get that gig? What gig did you get?
I got Nurse Jackie.
So that was it. That was your first gig,
and then it was my gig for 7 seasons, and I grew up on that show, which was great because it shot in New York. It was Edie Falco. Like, the showrunners were great.
Who are the showrunners? Who produced that thing?
It was Linda Wallum and Liz Brixius.
And people like that show. I've not seen an episode of it.
That's okay.
I feel bad sometimes. I don't know how people find the time.
I don't either. It's cool. But I mean, it was a great show to work on, and I learned.
She's great.
Everything. She's spectacular. Everybody was.
And
like, to make a TV show in New York feels like a unicorn situation too.
How many people were on the staff?
It ballooned. It was like big at first, and then it contracted. It was like 8 people, and then it was 6 people, and then it went back up again. You know, it depended on the year, and it changed. And it started writing out here, and then it moved back to New York. So
that was it. That's what you've done. You've written two plays and Nurse Jackie, and
then
now
did
created.
Homeland for a minute, and then created Glow.
You did Homeland for a minute?
Yeah. I did drama for a minute. It was crazy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What was the shift like? What happens? What's the difference?
I mean, I went from being great at my job to being terrible at my job. That was the biggest shift. But they were very cool to me. I mean, I got to, you know, produce something in Berlin. I got to come in for half a season. They let me co-write a finale. It was...
Less collaborative than comedy writing?
Just different. I mean, like, the way you have to break... Like, I had never broken an action sequence before, and that was...
I don't even know what that means.
Exactly. And it's just like...
Stop, drop, and roll.
Yeah,
shoot the gun.
Right. But you're like, so they're in the tunnel, and then these guys are, you know, these guys are here, and this information is here, and we've got to get all these people. And it just, it's really, they're good at it, but it's really rigorous and painstaking.
It's as rigorous as the action on screen. The writing process is mentally rigorous.
It was really rigorous, and you know, you can't come in with like a nugget of delight or like this delightful thing that we can blossom into a story. It was just
very poetic. No. Where's the gun?
But I had to give a note, which was also maybe the last time I'll do this, which was like, can we just lift that gun up higher so we can see it? Like, I'll probably never give that note again.
I don't know. I might lose my shit in
That's
the second
true.
Season of Glow
I
if we get it.
I should not say that now. We're going to have a fucking gun.
Yeah, you're going to lift a gun Here up to go. My head.
That's I mean, the wrestling sequences are action-y.
They are. I mean, that's the closest I think I'll ideally
Yeah, very beautifully choreographed. I found myself, and I say it all the time, it was like watching a ballet of some kind. I found it to be moving.
As theater people, we only exclusively talk about the wrestling in terms of dance choreography.
Well, I told you guys when we got in there that it felt like a stage, that the ring is definitely
a
stage.
A squared circle. It's like a sacred space.
It definitely had that feeling, you know, and special. When you're in it. Yeah. So, all right. So where'd you go? You wrote your four plays and then what happened?
Actually, the first play, another playwright, Rollin Jones, who was working on Weeds at the time, came up to me after the play and said, I'm working on Weeds. I think Genji would love this. Can I pass her your play? And until then, I hadn't even thought about TV, to be honest. Like, I was living in the bubble of this could work.
Yeah.
I was going to Juilliard at the time.
You were?
I was.
As a playwright?
As a playwright.
That's fancy.
Yeah. It sounds really fancy, and then really you just meet once a week for 3 hours and feel bad about yourself and then get a stamp at the end.
Oh, that's great.
It's like being knighted.
Yeah, right. And did you get knighted?
I did. I got knighted too early. Like, I think I hadn't really found my voice. I was just so... I had never studied theater.
Yeah.
So I felt a little bit like a fraud while I was there because I didn't know plays that well. But I was just at the point where I was getting really excited about them. But it'd be like I'd come into school and be like, have you guys heard of this guy Tennessee Williams? Because he's got some shit that I think we should
really
talk about.
Couple of really good ones.
And I didn't really know Shakespeare, and like the actors would get so excited over Shakespeare, and I'd be like, I just can't understand these plays. Like,
I have a hard time with Shakespeare.
I'm so confused why you guys are so excited. These feel so out of date.
Biggest problem is drifting. And then once you drift for 5 minutes in Shakespeare, you're like, I'm fucked. This is all pointless. I don't know.
I was barely
understanding it to begin with.
I have premise problems, too. Like, I can't get on board with certain... Like,
when you start unwinding a premise, we're done.
Like, King Lear, like, I just get so pissed at that first scene where it's like, why? Like, who starts a play by saying, like, who loves me the most? Like, I don't care about
this
guy. What
do you mean? We just started a presidency like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's very relevant, Carly. It's a very relevant play. Couldn't be more relevant.
Yeah, the sort of angry ambition of aging people is why we're in the mess we're in.
It's true.
I've had this conversation with her a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I bet, over and over again.
Well, and then I took this one class at school where I was in opera class, and she said, anytime you're not enjoying opera, walk out. Like, preserve your ability to love it in the future by just sparing yourself the pain of
sitting there. Never seen an opera the way through.
I've never seen an opera all the way through, but I applied it to Shakespeare. So now I kind of, like, I don't let myself sit there getting angry. Like, if I'm connecting and getting it, I stay, but then...
I think that's smart. Yeah. I mean, I do that with my kids,
I'll go home and try to read
it. You leave your kids if they're not engaging.
I do. I was like, well, this is not working for me. I'm going to walk out.
You guys are boring me. Maybe take it up a notch. Do something fun and exciting.
Like, where's mommy? It's like, she couldn't. You weren't doing it for her.
Not enough drama. Can't be a shortage of drama with kids.
There's not.
So you've got two, right?
I've got two.
And now you have one in your stomach.
I do.
Yeah.
Coming out in a month.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
That's also a great question.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Sounds
excited,
like it.
Excited, confused, anxious.
Confused? What do you mean? Yeah. You know how it happened.
I think it's because I've been in denial for most of the months of this pregnancy, including while we were on set.
Yeah.
It's abstract.
And then I went to that birthing class where they show you the 18-minute video of a couple late
coming out.
And then you're like, that just mathematically, that doesn't make sense.
I don't know how you women do it.
Yeah.
Well, my original goal is just go to the hospital and tell them to just get it out as fast as possible.
I think that's fine.
That's what my mother did.
Yeah.
Cut it right out.
Yeah.
I don't need to be a hero.
The next 18 years, I don't.
How'd you do yours? Regular?
Regular.
Oh, my God.
Through my vagina.
So,
both of them.
So what do you tell her to, what's the advice you're getting from your
pal? It's one day. That's the good one, even. She keeps telling me, like, it's one day.
It's one day. It's like you're, it's like, if everyone freaks out about their, it's one day of your life. It's one day. It's like your wedding. It's like, what are you going to focus on, like the wedding or the marriage? It's like the birth or the life of the baby.
Right.
So it's one day, it'll be what it is.
But I imagine you hit a threshold of pain where you just transcend.
It's called the ring of fire. There's a name for it.
Yeah.
Oh, I've learned the terminology.
I remember I did a lot of, I would like have contractions and just hit things rhythmically to like get through it and then it'd stop. My husband fell asleep for a lot of my, I was like, so how long was that? He's like, I don't know. I fell asleep.
Off.
And I was like, all right, well,
here
we go.
It's happening.
See how this is going to go.
My plan is to watch the Great British Baking Show.
That's good. That'll really
cool
you out.
And hope that at some point during the season, the child will have slipped out.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Just right, like, oh, look. Oh, that was that hilarious scene. And what was it? What's that Monty Python movie? I don't remember what it was, but there's just a woman, you know, washing dishes and there's nine kids around and one just falls out of her. She's like, oh, there's another one. It was the meaning of life, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So you're both writing on these different shows, but you knew each other. And then how does it evolve?
Well,
like,
then,
where do you make this decision?
Well, I had moved up in the ranks on Nurse Jackie.
Yeah.
The creators had left, and then these other EPs had come in, and then I got promoted to EP and got to help them hire the room.
Yeah.
And one of the first people I ran after was Carly. So I'm like, I get Carly in this room.
But was she working?
You were not.
I was
a
playwright,
like,
which means.
Yeah.
But wait, this is before Weeds?
After Weeds.
After Weeds.
So you were so you had done TV.
So I'd done 3 years of Weeds. Then I was taking a year off, tried some plays. Then I did Nurse Jackie. Then I did Orange.
Okay. Oh, so you
it's
brought
like
her.
In
I get
the,
it. I get it. So you were like, fuck TV.
I was like,
she says, okay. I mean, you do, like, you said no to a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
You really had you had your heart set on being a big playwright, huh?
Not even a big playwright. There's just something romantic about being in New York and writing things no one will ever read or see.
Yeah, romantic.
Reaching almost.
I find theater like this ritual, special space that I can't let go of in terms of, like, I'm someone who is, that's the closest place to spirituality I have. So I kind of find it.
Yeah.
Do you go a lot?
I go all the time. And it's the one thing I miss the most about New York. Because I think I see like 3 plays a week at least in New York when I'm there. And
really?
Here. Yeah.
Well, she lives in Midtown, but it's like you can just do that. Like,
I know,
you're just there.
Like, it breaks my heart what I'm missing right now.
I know.
But like as I got older, even maybe when I was younger, I was sort of like, is it good? Because like I don't know if I can.
You see so many duds. You have to put up with a lot of shit to get to the good stuff. But then I feel like the good stuff is so
Much better than anything else.
It's like, so magical,
It's just, I don't want to feel bad.
Yeah.
Like, when I see bad theater, it's not sort of like, this sucks. It's like, oof.
You're trapped. You're in a room that you can't leave.
Yeah, because sometimes you literally are.
Yeah.
There's like four
other
people.
When I see a bad play, I literally try to go across the street and go to the movies and like eat as much candy and popcorn and be like, fuck you, theater. I'm having so much fun. I'm being entertained. I can eat.
I like it. I'm very moved by it. Yeah. And I would go more. Maybe if I lived in New York at this age, I would go more.
Something to do.
Yeah. And it's human.
Very human,
Yeah, there's something about seeing
Someone
spit,
made that, I can see. Yeah.
Seeing people, like, the actual spit come out of their mouth and seeing them shuffle around, you hear the boards. It's exciting.
And being in rehearsal is kind of the best. I mean, I like having plays perform, but I love a rehearsal room.
Time just works differently, too.
Yeah.
Well, no, so like, that's why it's so essential and why it was always considered essential is there's a real humanity to it. That the power of people on stage with their own voice to move stories and elevate is, like, it's amazing.
It is, but because I feel like I get asked this a lot, like, how is theater and TV different, and do they inform each other when you work on both? And I find TV very human, too, and mostly because you can use a camera to get up in someone's face and really see.
Well, yeah,
like,
you have a lot more.
There's an intimacy that you can't.
Yeah.
It's a different type of humanity, but I.
No. I know. I see what you're saying, but I'm just, like, the point
is. It's very
is,
handmade and very kind of.
Well, there's a distance, you know. Your engagement with it is your decision. Whereas a play, I mean, your engagement with it is pretty present. You may be drifting, but you know, there's someone demanding something of you on stage. Whereas a TV, you're
in
like,
real time,
mute it.
Yeah.
You can't mute the guy.
Right. You also can't mute the people in the bathroom after your play talking about your play, which I actually kind of like. I used to hate, and now I kind of love.
That's the second act, the second play,
the second,
sequel.
Yeah, the sequel.
Just sit in the bathroom.
Has anyone done that? Where the first act is like the play, and then this entire second act is the bathroom.
It's just the bathroom and people talking.
That'd be funny.
Not bad.
All right, so she's on Nurse Jackie. You hired her.
Yeah, and then we did that for two seasons. And then we just started talking about. I mean, we loved working together,
right?
And then
we never wrote together. We just kind of worked together well in a room.
Yeah,
and it just felt organically fun.
So where did the concept come from?
Yeah, so I was watching this documentary. It felt insane that this world of women's wrestling in the 80s hadn't been explored since.
Yeah.
It felt like it hit a lot of themes and places we wanted to go. Just
the GLOW documentary.
GLOW documentary and just the world of... We've been talking about... Because we'd both written for shows about badass weird women.
Yeah.
But I don't think we'd ever talked about maybe going back into the 80s and looking at like... what was life like for women in the 80s. Anyway, I saw this insane thing. I came... Liz was on maternity leave.
I was home with my colicky daughter.
Yeah.
So I needed some stuff to do.
We watched it. Within 30 seconds, we're like, we should work on this. I think we sent...
I think that day, we sent Genji an email.
It was like
Carly
a one...
was like, meet Liz. Not even a pitch.
No, it was a one-line email. I was like, do you want to make a TV show about women's wrestling in the 80s? And I think her response was just yes.
Yeah.
And then we basically like went away for a... You know, we had to deal with like the rights and then looking into that. But then we just went away for almost a year and worked on the pilot. And then...
And kind of had to make it our own and get into the story.
Uh-huh.
And rewrite it a million times and re-break it a million times.
We also knew nothing. We both knew nothing about wrestling and also didn't like wrestling that much. So it took us a while to kind of find our way in that felt honest, but also kind of embracing the insane circus.
And that way in was through the personalities of the women in a way.
And I think on a meta level, like we chose a specific show about women who knew nothing about wrestling, who became wrestlers. So we could kind of go on the journey with them as they figured out like what the hell this
And also the premise being that, you know, it was put together as a TV show, really.
Yeah.
That helps that.
A lot.
Yeah. And then, like, there's something about being on set, for me, those outfits. And I was conscious and awake, like, in the 80s. I graduated high school in 81, so I'm already, like, 23 when that's happening.
Right. Yeah.
And they were so, like, I like that you guys played it so straight and it wasn't campy other than the nature of it, essentially. Yeah.
That was a big part of it for us.
To not overplay it.
Yeah.
To just play it straight.
Well, we have the ring, which is this heightened, campy space. So then the fun of the show seems to be finding how to use the ring versus real life as a way to...
You know, to casually deal with the 80s fashion is difficult because it was so just casually women did with their hair. Just to go out in the morning was crazy.
That was a big conversation when we were just talking to, you know, when we were hiring makeup heads and department heads. We were talking about just wanting this sort of like dusty, realistic late 70s into the 80s. So it felt like you weren't being bombarded by like neon and studs and stuff like that.
Because and we went through a lot of our old pictures too so that we would make sure we were...
The pastels were just unnerving.
Oh, yeah. Beth Morgan called it her coral dream. It was just like a real...
I just don't like... There were days where I'm like, how did anyone think this was a good idea?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The crew was so amazing and respectful, too, because there were a lot of women in, like, leotards. And they were very, very cool. But I remember I got a text one day from Christian Springer, our DP, that just said... You know, I just want to check in with you. There's a lot of nipple showing right now. It's just a little cold in here. So I wonder if maybe we turn down the AC. Let me know.
From the beginning, like one of the things that attracted us to the show is how uncomfortable we were with women in bathing suits, you know, wrestling for mostly a male audience.
Yeah.
Like that discomfort is where we started.
Right.
Like, we didn't want you to be comfortable. Even though, I mean, they look amazing. But also, like, it's both exploitative and empowering at the same time, and it should never be just one.
And wrestling is, like, attract and repel for us, too.
It feels to me that what was going on set would, in real time, them learning and them building these relationships and also doing this ballet of wrestling and creating these personas was happening, you know, both in reality and on screen.
It's why we planned the first season to go so slowly and to reflect... the actual learning process of how long it would take to pick up these moves and to even understand the inner logic of what a wrestling match is. I think there was a day on set where they were 4 weeks into training.
Yeah.
And it occurred to Chavo, our wrestling trainer, he was like, raise your hand if you know how a wrestling match ends. Not a single person raised their hand. And we realized, of course, it wasn't obvious to any of us. Like, we were just learning the moves. Like, we didn't know how you win, and none of the writers knew either.
Well, but did you knew that there was a script?
Yeah, we knew that wrestling was scripted, but in terms of just like physically how it works.
You mean the count and all that?
Like the counter, like how do you know when it's done? And like, what does that actually
mean? We didn't
know
your two shoulders need to touch the ground. Like, no one told us that.
Yeah.
Wow.
They told us.
I mean, we were beginners. And it was great because we would actually go and watch them train.
Oh, but Allison, that's the other thing I want to say. It's like, how did you guys, did you know how that relationship would go?
What relationship?
Me and Allison? Because that turned into something.
We didn't know. I mean, honestly, it was, a lot of it was, like, we had stuff in the script that we knew sort of the primary arcs of a lot of those, our main characters. But I feel like it's also stuff that when you see, it was like how vibey you guys were, how great you were together, how great she and Betty are together. I mean, that.
Yeah, we definitely took cues, but I think we had hoped that there would be some type of a connection. We just didn't fully know what kind of a connection it would be. And then it was.
The one with me and Allison is kind of odd.
It is.
And it's like touching.
Yeah.
Somehow. I don't know what to do with Betty. Yeah. In character out. Yeah.
She's a force.
She's
a real force. She's amazing. We've known her for a long time because Betty has, is in the theater world and like she's done readings of my plays and then she was on Nurse Jackie. And so we've sort of seen what she can do. And now I feel like she's like, I'm excited to unleash her on the world.
So what was the casting process like? And tell me about me because I'd like to know, because I got that thing. I wasn't anticipating doing anything. I was not planning on doing anything.
We did not even bring you into a room.
I know.
We cast you off a tape.
Yeah,
But I was told you weren't looking at people here.
What do you mean? That we weren't looking at people in LA?
No, I got a script. Here's how this went for me.
Yeah, tell us on your side and then we'll tell you on our side.
I think somebody in my manager's office who was just going through scripts found it and then gave it to my manager. And then he gave it to my agent. And then they sent it to me. And it was, I don't even know if I got the whole script or sides. Mm-hmm. And I'm just having a day. Wasn't looking for anything. I was actually just done with my show and was going to take a year off. Not even do stand-up. I was like, I'm done for a while.
That'll show you.
Yeah, and then they sent me this script, and I'm like, oh, I know this guy. Okay, I could do this. And it wasn't even, I didn't know you. I don't even think I knew it was Genji to begin with, or put it together because I'm shitty at that. So I'm like, I could do this guy. So I went down to the glasses place.
We wanted to know what
spectacles.
What was up with those glasses because they...
I immediately decided that I needed aviators. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of aviator glasses because I knew they were timeless and that they would, there was no way I was going to find fashion glasses from 86. I wouldn't even be able to identify them, but I knew aviators never change and that this guy was going to wear aviator glasses. And then I had Lacoste shirts. And I'm like,
did you buy the glasses or did you rent? Did you borrow?
No,
the
I just borrowed those big
rent,
ones.
Did you rent the glasses?
They were sort of like yellowish,
that's
and but
big
it was
commitment for an audition.
It was the shape. No, I know ladies down there.
Yeah,
they do my glasses.
I love that place. They do mine too.
So, and then I actually own Lacoste shirts, and again, I'm like, these have been the same for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. And then I had the woman who's my trainer, who's an actress, read.
You
with
wondered
me.
Who was reading with you?
Yeah, I was like, because she's she goes on auditions and stuff, and she's cute and good. But usually she's just my trainer. I work out with her and I'm like, do you want to read with me? And that would at least lend some professionalism to it.
And you sat behind a desk, which looks...
Yeah.
It was in my office. I just sat at that table and my part-time assistant shot three of them and they decided they sent you one and that was that. But they told me that I didn't know where you were in the casting or whether you had considered other people or you're at your wit's end, but I was told that they're not looking at people, that I could not get in a room. That's what I was told.
We were not yet seeing people that we liked enough to see in a room for that.
Oh.
I think we were.
So you were still looking.
Well,
for
we should
room.
Say Jen Houston, who did the casting, is a genius, and she has these instincts that are so kind of out of left field and so kind of. They're so.
I've
surprising
known Jen
and weird.
Since she was a kid.
Yeah, she
and
told
she
us.
Worked. Yeah,
she sent it to us, and she was like, "Watch this now."
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, whoa, all right, maybe. Guys.
Yeah.
I think Mark Maron?
You can be honest. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was not expecting anything. I was like, he's funny.
Yeah.
I don't know if he can act.
Uh-huh.
Can he play another person?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Or can he be some version of himself that is that person?
Yeah. And then we watched it, and it was so simple. It was just like, he's the guy.
Like, it was like undeniable. It was like one of those things where we're like, shit, this is undeniable.
we didn't really
remember,
overthink
it. And then we showed it to the writers, too. Remember? Because like, we were like, you guys, you got to watch this. And then we were like, oh. And then when we would start to talk about the character, we started to talk like you.
Yeah.
Like, when we were pitching, we were like, oh, we're already writing it for him. We got to give him the part.
And then I remember we sent the video to Netflix, and they said their only question was, like, can he move around?
He's behind a desk. I'm like, well, even if he can't, does it matter?
I'm like, well, can we write the part so he's always sitting? Like, if that's the problem.
If he's not an integrated performer, we'll just sit him down. It's totally fine.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah.
But it was, and a couple were like, I mean, I feel like that was particularly, because we knew it was going to be such a big part of the show. So to not even have you in a room, we were just like, well, this feels like it's the guy.
I had no
so
expectation. I was sort of like, a tape? All right, there you go. And
I
just went on with my life.
I had no expectation when we watched it. And then I will say it kept happening over the course of the season where I was like, I mean, he's going to be great, but who knows what his range is. Like, he's got, he's like.
You
I
the
think
one.
He feels super.
Liz liked me the whole time. Liz was on board from the day one.
The beauty of you from the beginning was I was like, he will be grounded and a real human, no matter what at all.
No matter what we throw
like,
at him.
You got a great bullshit meter and a beautiful ability to just make anything sound organic and moment and true. But then you consistently surprise us in ways that I feel like we would go back to our seats and be like, that
whoa,
was,
yeah.
Like, that scene was so powerful. That wasn't even meant to be so.
I felt that happening.
Powerful.
Like, I think that was because.
It was exciting.
Well, I think you got me at a good time because I just done 4 seasons of my show. So, like, you know, when I started Marin, I was not great, but like, I knew how to be on set now.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted to be relaxed and not have it all on my shoulders. So I was able to focus on, you know, just that guy and not worry about other shit, which was, you know, kind of tricky. I still needed to sit near Video Village just to.
We noticed. I'm like, he just wants to be closer to Video Village because. But you were also so empathic toward us because you knew what it was like to, you know, run a show. So I feel like every time we'd look like we had the blood drained out of us, you'd be like, how you guys doing? You all right? You okay? And it's like, well, it's really nice when somebody asks you and you're like barely standing.
Yeah, it's rough.
It's hard.
Yeah,
we had each other. So
it was hard for me to, like, I think that you guys were, everybody was pretty open to things, like, you know, suggestions. And it wasn't, didn't seem out of hand. And I like that there wasn't like a fucking improv fest because I really wanted to do the work from the script, but you know, certain directors and certain writers.
You were word perfect for pretty much the entire season.
It was great.
Well, because like that, you know, the one thing I had in my mind, if I had any insecurity, like, and I think that like I can evolve as an actor after talking to Martin Landau in here and getting some acting lessons, but I know I can be present. I knew that the answer for me was going to be, if it's not me, it's on the page. So let it be. And there was a couple of bits that like worked out. There was a couple of beats that I added, but you know, that was with the writers and there was conversations around it. Yeah. And there was one moment where, you know, I didn't want to do something and Nick, you know, and I was like, let's just do it this way. And he's like, it wasn't a fight, but he's like, all right, okay. And then like we tried to admire when he's like, okay, so now let's do it the way that we.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, totally.
But that took early on.
That took a lot
of
trust from you though. Cause like, you don't know who we are.
Right.
You know,
well, you know, I liked that. I wasn't afraid of it because it wasn't on me. You know what I mean? It was your character in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, there was only a couple times where I'm like, and we went over it where it's just like, I don't know if he's going to say that. I just didn't feel right. And it didn't matter. Like we fixed it.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of what, I think playwriting prepares you for TV in a great way because you're in that rehearsal room with actors and you're working like that and you're trying to work it on the page first before you go off and rewrite something. So you're really trying to figure out if it's the scene that needs work, you know, and what that work is. And it's a conversation and, you know, you have to be able to have it faster, I think, with TV because you are in the middle of shooting.
Yeah, but that's the exciting thing about it. Yeah.
It teaches you not to be precious, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't assume that, like, the amazing thing was because of the script and then just because I was emotionally available, you know, and I knew, you know, where that guy was at or the guy I was being.
Yeah.
That the way the relationships evolved or, you know, just happened with the different women was really kind of interesting to me. Like, you know, because clearly, you know, Allison and I love each other in some weird way. And that
you guys hugged a lot on set.
Well, yeah, because but I didn't know, like, you know, like, she's so good. It's sort of like you're just doing this because for the show. she, you know, she definitely had my number, you know what I mean? Yeah. On stage and yeah. off. It was a genuine emotional relationship somehow yeah. that we couldn't really admit in a way.
Yeah. Well, ideally, there's genuine emotion in those scenes and you guys found it and
yeah.
took it, you know.
And I hated it when it didn't happen. Like, it did, like if we do a take and I'm like, oh, it wasn't open enough. Yeah. And then, like, there was everyone was different. The weirdest one for me, I had to sign the nudity thing. I'm like, when's this going to happen? And then you made me show my butt.
Yep.
And I had to walk around set with a sock on my dick.
Yep. I remember having that conversation with you, and you're like, so what? What is it? And I was like, so we just want to have a conversation about nudity? And you're like, well, seems only fair, right?
It did seem fair. I was kind of pissed.
I was like, that's true. It does seem fair. Maybe we should have made you do a little more.
We'd ask the women to show their tits all the time.
I kind of knew that. I think the ass was about as far as I could go, though.
Yeah, yeah. It looks great.
My ass looks good?
Ass looks good.
Oh, good.
We definitely used it.
I was nervous about it. The one thing that that in retrospect that I think we should have played more. You want to do that? Can we do those kind of
conversations? Notes. We're getting notes now?
Notes.
For season two.
I think I should have acknowledged the mess more. Like, I think, like, the one regret I have about the whole season is that...
The period blood mess or the emotional mess?
No, the period blood mess.
Yeah, okay.
Like, when she leaves, where I'm at the door, there should have been a beat where I'm like, oh, God. Like, because it's a mess. And, like, I was so involved with sort of, like, everything was sort of loaded because my ass was out. So the set becomes sort of like, there's an ass out, you know, and, like...
It would have helped you, too, if we poured fake blood on you. I feel like maybe...
Well, now that we know you're open to it.
Yeah, there's...
period blood?
Always more.
There's always more period blood on this
show. You know, it happens. You know, you're going to do what you're going to do.
It's a very honest scene.
Oh, no, I got to watch them. So, all right, so what's going to... When do we know about another season?
I don't know. I
mean,
We don't know. We'll tell you. But they've been very... I mean, I got to say, like, that's the cool thing about... I mean, I've only worked at Showtime and Netflix.
Yeah.
But the great thing about... The way we've gotten to make this show, be it like Genji's support and having, you know, that as sort of a creative like sounding board and buffer, but we have so much freedom there. It's pretty astonishing.
And genuine enthusiasm, which is pretty fun, because even when we originally pitched the show, sitting in the room was this guy, Ted Biaselli, who was from the family programming department. Heard there was a show being pitched about GLOW. He was obsessed with GLOW.
Yeah.
Got himself in the room.
And invited himself to the pitch because he heard it was about GLOW. Uh-huh. He's like, I have to be in this pitch.
Yeah.
And he's our creative contact at Netflix, and he's someone who is so genuinely giddy, and he's such a cheerleader, which is rare, I think, and it makes the whole process just feel more human. And
yeah, I felt the set was really kind of open and good, and there was no weirdness really ever, and everybody was very excited. Now, are you guys in your head? Do you have a second season?
In our heads right now?
Yeah.
We have stuff. I mean, we have a...
Because so many of the characters are unexplored.
Totally.
Really.
So many. I mean, we've just scratched the surface on basically
feels like there's so many characters we want to delve into. There are so many weird... There's weird shit about wrestling, weird shit about the 80s. We've got a kind of laundry list of things we want to shove in. But do we have the kind of the shape of season two yet?
Not yet.
I think we're
that's good. Because there's always, that's one thing I learned about doing TV. It's like you always assume like these geniuses have like all eight seasons mapped out, but you don't.
Well, you don't. But I also think like you have to respond to like what happened. And also, I mean, just cutting the first season was really informative in terms of how the wrestling, you know, what we wanted from the wrestling and how it shot and how it came together. And, you know, that's a learning curve.
The joy of a writer's room, by the way, also is coming up with the ideas.
Right, it's fun, yeah.
It's fun.
But, like, in your mind, though, do we just pick up right after that first match kind of deal? Like, are we just going back to sort of, like, that went well, now let's build from there? No, the time go by thing, that's always weird. Like, with my show, I could do it, like, this is a year later. Like,
I mean, we could go either way. We have some arguments for both sides.
Okay.
Well,
it was great working with you. All right, do you feel good about what we've done here?
This has been fun.
Yeah.
Good.
We love you, Mark. We were looking forward to talking to you.
I know. It's really an honor.
Yeah.
And it's made me like very cool with the dads at school too. They're like,
oh, really?
I heard Mark Maron say your name on his podcast.
No.
I was like, yeah. He's
oh, really?
He's Play Hive. They're like, yeah.
We got excited like that you knew our last names.
Silver Lake Dads?
Silver Lake Dads are really.
that makes sense.
That's really nice for me.
All right. Well, here we go.
All
Thanks
right,
for
man.
Talking.
Thanks, Mark.
There you go. Our final episode of GLOW-related interviews. And I think that was informative. I hope you writers got a lot out of that. And I hope you people enjoyed the process. Making the sausage. We do some sausage-making shows here at WTF on occasion. Don't forget about the 10th Annual Men's Warehouse National Suit Drive happening July 1st to 31st. Donate your gently used professional attire, including suits, slacks, dress shirts, ties, and more to any Men's Warehouse store. Visit menswarehouse.com/national-suit-drive. That's menswearhouse.com/national-suit-drive. As a thank you for donating, you'll receive a coupon for 50% off regular price retail items and get $10 off your $50 purchase when you text NSD to 66960. Dig it. Oh, it's too hot. Too hot to play guitar. Maybe I will, though. I got to put my ear plug in. My ears are old. Are yours getting old? Gotta go fluff some rice. Boomer lives!